Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for December the 2nd, 2019. This is David Corey, along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Before we get started, I'd like to give a shout-out to my daughter Rose, who's stuck at an airport in the Northeast due to some winter snowstorms. I heard they had over a foot of snow. Rose, if it's any consolation, we've got a foot of white snow. I'm sorry, that's not snow. That's white sand at the beaches here in Florida. So I hope you enjoy the cold weather up there. Little chuckle from Dad here. So hope everyone will stay tuned for a fast hour of news and information for our veterans and their families tonight. But first, over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David, and good evening. Hey, Rose. Good luck to you there. I used to live up in the Northeast, so I know all about that white snow and being stuck in airports and stuck inside the home, and so get yourself a nice blanket, some hot chocolate, and maybe a fire, and kind of enjoy the evening. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our Veterans News Hour. We don't have a guest tonight, but we are going to spend this evening talking about a lot of different topics which affect you veterans. David will go through them in a second. But as you listen to the different topics, this might be a great opportunity for you to pick up the phone and give us a call. You know, it is the Veterans News Hour, and this is your show. We're just here as the messengers, and we're trying to help veterans get their message across to the people of this country, Congress, and anyone else who will listen that may have a positive impact on you veterans. Like I said, it is a call-in show, so give us a call. We welcome your views, your comments, and any questions you may have. That number, get a pencil here or a pen, is 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. It's really easy. Just pick up the phone and call. Our producer will patch you in, and we'll be happy to take your call. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. And there's so much we can talk about. Some of the issues that I thought might be of interest tonight would be, Richard, to discuss our perceptions and insights of the VA appeal system. I know you've had a lot of experience in the last year in dealing with the ramifications of the disability appeal system and the changes that were made by Congress that went fully into effect in February of this year of 2019. But there's some other big issues out there that I'm sure our listeners are interested in, including the ongoing legal battles in Congress and the courts on issues like the open-air burn pits that were used in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Agent Orange issue for Vietnam veterans who served in the so-called Blue Water Navy off the coast of Vietnam, as well as Camp Lejeune. So why don't we start by talking about the Veterans Appeals Improving the Modernization Act. It was passed by Congress in 2017, signed into law August 23rd of 2017. And the way Congress wrote the law, they gave Congress and they gave the VA a year and a half, 18 months, to start implementing the changes in how veterans will appeal their disability claims decisions. So a year and a half went by, the VA implemented what they called the RAMP, the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program, kind of on a trial basis where veterans were invited to opt into this new system. They weren't required to, but now the 18 months went by, and in February of this year, 2019, it became fully effective. So any decisions that are being made now on disability claims, veterans will receive in their decision package some forms that outline their new options. And there's three options, basically, if they get a decision they're unhappy with. Maybe their claim was denied, or maybe they were given a low disability rating. So they've got three choices now, and that sounds like a good thing. You know, you've got three choices, lots of options, But as Richard and I are going to talk about, there are some pitfalls. And kind of the bottom line, I think, is that these changes primarily benefit the VA. What do you think, Rick?
Yeah. It just seems like the process today is just more of the same, if not worse, than the past, because it's my opinion and the way I'm seeing it and the way the cases are coming in, it's just more paperwork and frustration for the veteran. I mean, it's frustrating for me as the attorney for the veteran. I can only imagine what it's like for a veteran who has to pick up the mail and you know, act upon whatever they say. And here's an example. It just so happens while we were waiting to go on the air this morning or this evening, I was doing my mail, and I've got a 90-year-old veteran, female, served in Korea, and we filed a claim for PTSD as a result of military sexual trauma. Well, we filed it under the 0995 because she had originally said that her case was previously denied. So I get a letter back saying, and those letters are very dismissive, as if, you know, we're idiots or something, saying that I've used the wrong form. So, and they never tell you why you use the wrong form. They just say, you use the wrong form. So now you've got to figure out, and it's not, it's either form A or form B. So what did I do? I used the other form, which is for a brand new claim, and sent that in, because according to the VA, it's a brand new claim. Well, I opened up the mail today, and it said, you need to use 0995 as those two issues were previously denied. So, I mean, it's just, you're ready to pull your hair out.
Even though they were denied more than a year ago, right? I mean, even though the appeal period for the original decisions had long expired, is that right?
Oh, these go back to like 97, 98.
Yeah, so that's amazing.
You know, a veteran, when a veteran sits down to, and this is kind of the reality of the situation, and let's take the attorney out of the equation. The veteran sits down with a DAV or a VSO, and they file a claim with the DAV and VSO. Many times, the veteran has no idea all of the claims that are being asserted on behalf of that veteran, or not being asserted. The veteran also never receives a copy of the application. The DAV VSO just sends it in, and you know, whatever happens to it, happens to it. Now you fast forward to the present day. The veteran decides, well, you know, those claims, you know, were denied. Whatever happened to them, maybe I got 10%. And now the veteran wants to reopen. Veteran's older. Veteran's conditions are worse. And they say, you know, they come to me or you, David, and they say, you know, I've been recommended. You're a friend. You represented my friend. He had some positive results, and I'd like you to take over the case. Sure. So I sit down and do a lengthy interview, and the veteran, and this is no knock on the veteran just doesn't remember and doesn't have any paperwork to help me or help you, David, to assert which form we are going to use. So in a lot of ways, it is a guessing game. I mean, it's so ridiculous that recently I was so angry that I filed both forms at the same time and put all the claims on both forms.
Have you received a response from the VA yet?
That, I haven't gotten a response yet, but that way the VA, there's no way the VA can say I've used the wrong form.
There you go.
but that's how ridiculous this is. David, you remember, you know,
I got a story for you, Rick. Here's
go ahead.
One. a veteran that we've been representing since 2013, which was clearly when the old system was in place, and we had filed two notices of disagreement using the old notice of disagreement form because they denied some claims and lowballed the ratings. Okay, that's 2013, 2014, these notice of disagreements were filed. Fast forward, literally waiting years, in that period of time, they had issued their statements of the case. The VA had, we appealed those with VA Form 9s to the BVA. So September of this year, 2019, we finally get BVA hearings on all the issues. All right. We had the hearing, but I also faxed in, our appeal package, which was almost 30 pages of documents and a legal memo. I sent it directly to the BVA, but I also sent it to their evidence intake center in Janesville, Wisconsin, you know, to cover ourselves, because we know the VA is notoriously unpredictable on how they handle and manage the paperwork that comes in. Well, I get a letter a few weeks after that from the VA saying that they'd received, you know, the documents. And again, this is coming from what would be a regional office, not the BVA, saying they received the documents I'd sent in, and it appeared to them that we were seeking to appeal some issues. Of course, it doesn't elaborate what they think the issues are. And it suggested that what I needed to do was to properly file a notice of disagreement form. And you know what form they cited? Not one of the new ones, but the old notice of disagreement form. And they said we need to file that. Well, there were no new issues. These were all issues that we had filed NODs on, notice of disagreements, back in 2013, 2014. You know, so it was clearly a situation where, you know, the veteran gets this and is completely confused, because the VA letters also is very unclear. As I said, it doesn't talk about what issues, it doesn't identify what disabilities that it thinks that we had not properly appealed. But anyway, so I responded in writing, you know, asking them to clarify and explain what they're talking about. But I also know that all these issues were addressed with the BVA judge. I have a lot more confidence with the BVA, but just the mere fact that the VA Evidence Intake Center and then issues basically a regional office letter, which is clearly wrong on the facts of this case. Anyone that they'd even looked at the file, they would have seen that what I had faxed in September clearly referred to, even in the letters I sent in, it identified the NODs which had been filed, the issues, and they come back saying it looked like we're appealing issues. Well, yes, we are, and it clearly was addressed to the BVA. So the VA, you can never overstate the incompetence that you can get on a particular case with the VA. Now, you know, they don't always get it wrong, but they certainly leaves a lot to be desired, and it makes it very frustrating. People may wonder, you know, how do lawyers end up getting involved in this? It's because it's become an adversarial system because of the way Congress and the VA have approached it. They really put more of the burden, more of the work under this new system, this new so-called Improvement and Modernization Act. They put more of the burden on the veteran. Once the VA makes an initial decision, and you got three options, a higher level review where they don't take new evidence. They just look at the same evidence. You don't get a hearing. You may get a brief telephone conference, and that's it. The second option is you can file a supplemental claim. But there again, you, the veteran or the veteran's advocate, have to submit new and relevant information. The VA's, they say they might provide assistance in developing that evidence, but in my experience, they don't do much on that. And then
David,
the third option. Go ahead.
Let me jump in before we get to the third option. With regard to the higher level review, the people that I deal with over at the VA basically have all agreed that unless you have something glaring that the decision review officer made a mistake, and it's so obvious that the decision review officer was basically an idiot for making the decision that he or she made.
Or the initial adjudicator, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's recommended that you just do not select a higher level review, because you're not, unless it's so glaring that and so clear that they made a mistake, it's not going to get granted. And all you're doing is you're wasting more time. So you might as well move to the next level or another option. One thing I wanted to discuss with you, David, before we get to the appeal lane, on the supplemental claim lane, and you get those letters that say you have not submitted any new or relevant evidence. Well, these things are being pushed out real fast, and you know, our practice is always to make a FOIA request for the claims file. And it would seem to me that I would have the right to review a claims file before the VA is going to turn around and just deny the claim, saying on their end, I mean, they're basically judging it, saying there's no new and relevant evidence, therefore it's denied. Well, I don't have the claims file yet. I haven't had a chance to look at the veterans. You know, some of these claims files are 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000 pages long. I think right. I should have the right to take a look at that claims file. And, you know, maybe there's something in there that there is a mistake and I can pick up on it. And that would be new and clear, new evidence and relevant evidence to reopen the case. But we're not getting that opportunity to do that. And one part of my practice today is I'm making that known whenever I send these things, you know, when I file the paperwork in my fax cover sheet, I state right on there, you know, I have not yet received the C file. So it's premature for you to deny the claim when you haven't done your duty, which is to send me the C file. You know, I've started doing that over the last few months. I'm curious to see how that's going to play out. I know at the BVA level, if I haven't a chance to review the C file, the BVA is just going to kick the case back, because they're, you know, I've had judges tell me that it is the duty of the VA to provide that C file.
And I'll tell you what, if I could just share something.
Yeah, please.
We know for a fact that the VA, when properly motivated, can produce a C file within 30 to 45 days. And we know that because if you have the unfortunate need to appeal a Board of Veterans Appeals decision to the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, you know, that federal court as most federal courts do, they impose a pretty disciplined schedule on both parties. And that starts with, within a very short period of time, the VA having to produce a copy of not only the decision, the Board of Veterans Appeals decision that's being appealed, but also the entire record on appeal. And so the VA can, and they'll produce it on a computer disk, make it easy, searchable, a PDF file. So we know the VA can do it. They can do it when they have to. They just choose not to. And I had a case recently where as soon as I started representing the client, I put in a request for the C file. It seemed that it was ignored, waited a few months, filed a second one, and this time apparently got someone's attention, because within about 6 weeks after that, I finally got the C file. But Rick, you're absolutely right about you know, the importance of seeing what's in the C file, because they can be thousands of pages. I had one client, largest claims file, I think it was 8,000 pages, and it's very time-consuming going through there. But here's the tip that veterans need to be aware of. When they get that initial decision by the VA is supposed to list the evidence that they considered in the rating decision. They usually set that out on the first or second page of the rating decision. So you can see what evidence they considered, and the other side of the coin is what evidence they didn't consider. And if you know you've sent stuff in, whether it's a statement, whether it's a medical record or a statement from a doctor, and they haven't considered that, that itself is grounds for requiring the VA to do it over again. But I'll give you another example of a problem with this supplemental claim lane, which is the second option, because I used that a few months ago for a veteran, and what happened was when we submitted the claim for an increase, the veteran's condition had significantly worsened, had to go into assisted living facilities. So we submitted a claim with a detailed statement of his disabilities and the symptoms and how they'd worsened, and which I thought that would be enough to trigger a new VA medical decision. Right, Rick? That's what they should do. Well, they did not. But I guess they're trying to meet their new time standards, so they very quickly issued a denial saying you did not submit new and material evidence. And the case law is clear that a veteran is competent to testify as to his or her symptoms that a layperson can observe. Well, someone within the VA, within about a month, and I started to appeal that, but they recognized, I filed the appeal for that, but they recognized that they made a mistake. So what they did was, they claimed to have then scheduled him for the exams that they should have done originally. Of course, the veteran says he never got notice of the exams, and Rick, you and I know they never send a copy because it's usually coming from the medical side. I didn't get a copy of any notice of a compensation and pen exam. So what happened next? Within about a month, they issued another decision saying all your issues are denied because you didn't show up for your exams. You know, so again, just a lack of attention to detail by the VA. Really, they're acting in bad faith, you know, and so we've had to appeal those, and I've sent in multiple documents telling them, you know, the veteran never received the notice of the exam. He's ready, willing, and able to attend the exam. Please schedule it as soon as possible. But it's that sort of thing which just wastes time and is very frustrating. But there is this third option. You want to talk about the appeal to the board? What do you think of the Board of Veterans' Appeals, Rick?
Well, I think it's really the only avenue for these veterans because the BVA, in my opinion, does not have an agenda. And by that, I mean the VA's agenda is all about the money. And you ask any veteran, and they'll tell you the same thing. It's all about the money. And the BVA doesn't have that agenda. The BVA is trying to get it right. And the BVA analyzes the law, analyzes the cases, and unfortunately, you know, we have to take it to that step. And I just got one in today, you know, 10 issues, all remanded back. I tried to conference the case with a decision review officer and told him, hey, you know, I really think you're wrong on this. And unfortunately, you and I, David, know that a lot of them say, well, you'll probably win at the BVA level, but I can't do it here. Well, sure enough, I did. All 10 issues are coming back.
Yeah.
And we're going to be successful. And they're serious claims, and he's going to end up with 100%. But, you know, there again, you got to keep telling these veterans, you got to stay in the boat. That's my analogy. You got to stay in the boat. You got to keep paddling downstream, and whatever riptides are in your way, whatever rocks are in your way, you just got to move by it. And keep going, because eventually you are going to find nice, calm, peaceful waters. And that's because you end up going to the BVA, and the BVA kicks the case back, and very rarely will the VA then send it back to the VA, the BVA. And they will get it done. I'm not going to say try to get it done, but they usually will get it done. Maybe to their chagrin, and they're disappointed and everything else, but it does get done at that point. But it's just a necessary step.
Yeah. I think the Board of Veteran Appeals decisions the trend has been that I've seen in the last 10 years and even certainly 15 years and longer, is that their decisions have gotten better. They're more accurate, more thorough, and they tend to err more on the side of caution for the veteran, which may not result in a flat outright win, but at least you'll get, Rick, as you said, a remand where the BVA says to the regional office, you've messed up, you need to do it over again, and this is what you need to do right this time. You need to schedule a new medical exam. You need to go look for these records. you need to consider this evidence. But the weak point, the weak link in the entire system are these regional offices, because it's a complex set of rules. These people are under pressure. I think, you know, the time standards to try to crank these cases out, so quality suffers. And with the new system that we have here, it gives the VA every incentive to do that. They want to meet their time standards, and they get to do less work at the regional office after initial decision. This higher level review, they really don't have to do any more work. Like you were saying, Rick, is pretty much, you know, rubber stamping of what the initial decision was. Supplemental claim, again, is the burden is mostly on the veteran and the representative. And then the regional office doesn't really, you know, initially, you know, the veteran appealing to Board of Veterans Appeals under the third option, it puts all the work on the BVA. Of course, as we know, as you were saying, it eventually went often in a lot of cases end up in more work for the regional office when they kick it back with a remand decision. But I had a case recently where, going back to 2016, when we took the case on, we appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. We got a partial remand. They remanded it back to the Board of Veterans Appeals, who remanded it back to the regional office with instructions on what to do right. Well, the regional office totally messed it up. They didn't consider evidence that the court and the BVA had said, so they made another bad decision. Of course, this is wasting everyone's time. So we appealed that, goes all the way back to the BVA again, and guess what? They said, regional office, you've messed up again, got to do it over again. And that's where we're at this time. And hopefully we'll get a fair and favorable decision soon. But it is it requires persistence. Like you said, Rick, you got to keep rowing, stay in the boat, and be persistent.
But, you know, and this brings up another issue. You know, you and I both get cases for veterans who are older, a lot older, some in the mid to late 70s, even in the early 80s. And for some of them, this is their first go-around. Well, they don't have a lot of time. You know, they don't have a lot of time to, you know, file a claim, then file a supplemental claim, and then file to the appeal lane. I mean, you know, that's all, you know, for them, that's downtime. And, you know, if they have a spouse or something, maybe, you know, and they were to die, then the spouse can step in. But I mean, this year alone, I had six cases where the veteran finally got his check, his retro check, and these checks were anywhere from $100,000 to $150,000, and they were in hospice, and all of them died within 12 days, all of them.
Wow.
And five of them were combat Vietnam veterans, and, you know, I obviously, David, you and I both know we end up getting personally attached to a lot of these veterans. And I can tell you that in all of these cases, they were hanging on for no other reason than to make sure that check came in and that their wife was going to be able to get the check and put the money in the bank. Because they all these veterans told me prior to them getting the check and as they were dying, saying, I bet you anything, if I were to die before I get my check, the VA won't give them the check because they'll find out that I'm dead, so therefore they're not going to give the check to my wife. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah.
To have to think that way. You know, here you are, 18 years old, you go to Vietnam, whether you drafted or you volunteered, and all you're asking is for them to abide by the terms of the contract. The contract started when the soldier signed on the dotted line, and the contract doesn't end until the veteran's taken care of, and probably not until the veteran's dead. And even once he's dead, you still have benefits that are due the veteran after he's dead. So that's the extent. That's the life of the contract. And this is you know, I'm not a veteran, and I've made that clear on this show. I'm not a veteran. But just from a contractual point of view, from a lawyer's perspective, that's the contract. From the day I sign that thing, whether I'm 18 or 19 years old, until the day I die, and even after that, the government, our government, is on the hook to take care of me. And unfortunately, that philosophy that I'm expounding right now doesn't seem to be the way it really is. And I mean, you're a veteran, David. You know, so if I'm overreacting or overreaching, you tell me. But it just seems to me that that's the duty of the government through the VA and any other resource that the veteran has.
Well, I think what we see is we see a lot of good programs from the VA. They do a lot of good things, but on the same time, we see a lot of situations where there is just lip service, and then from members of Congress, from the VA, even from some veteran groups, and we see that we've seen that historically over decades with the Agent Orange issue, where it took decades of fighting to get the U.S. government to realize that the millions of gallons of these defoliants, these toxic substances that they sprayed, dumped over the jungles of Vietnam in order to defoliate, kill all the jungle so that the enemy didn't have a hiding place, that stuff actually might harm human beings. It took them decades to even acknowledge that. But we also see that with the current burn pit issue, where over in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, there were scores of these open burn pits, some of them, you know, the size of many, many, many football fields together. They were burning 24 hours a day, burning every conceivable type of waste in support of some military bases that were as large as, you know, 40, 50,000 troops. That's generating a lot of waste every day. And but that's an example, Rick, where I think there's a lot of lip service, and that's another issue. Maybe we can kind of segue to talking about the burn pit issue. We've had Lauren Price from Veteran Warriors Group on our show a number of times, even going back a couple years ago when we had Greg Levitt, the producer of the Burn Pit documentary, Delayed and I Hope You Die, that, you know, 2 years after that film came out, and that film was his purpose was to get people's attention. And, you know, they even had some screenings of it up in Washington. And it was sent to people in, you know, high positions of power. Now, what do we have 2 years after that film came out? One thing we want to talk about, a news report that I just saw a couple days ago from First Coast News, website in Florida, and it's reporting on so-called bipartisan legislation introduced in Congress, in the Senate, on Thursday, November 21st, so just a couple weeks ago. And the purpose of this legislation is called the Veterans Burn Pits Exposure Recognition Act, Senate Bill 2950. Now, you might think, when I saw this, I thought, oh, man, maybe this is what we're waiting for. Maybe this is a bill that will actually create a list of presumptive diseases in which there's a presumptive service connection, right? Just like the Agent Orange list that we finally have. Well, no. All this bill does is, and it hasn't even been enacted, it's just been referred to the Committee on Veteran Affairs. This bill is a lame, half-hearted, token effort of lip service, basically. But these members of Congress will say, look what we're doing to help the veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. What does this proposed bill do? It doesn't create automatic benefits. It doesn't link any diseases. All it says is that it would be a recognition that veterans who served over there, that served near burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan and some other locations, it would acknowledge that they were, in fact, exposed to airborne hazards, toxins, and particulate matters. That's really the extent of it. And meanwhile, allow the VA to continue what will probably be an endless, ultimately negative effort to study the health of these veterans and to study the effect of these exposure. When in fact, you know, why in the United States would similar things, or are similar things, of open burn pits illegal under EPA rules? It's because of the toxic contamination, the harm to human health. So this bill, I was really disappointed to find out that this is a very lame effort. What I think ought to happen is that these congressional committees need to do their job. They need to hold hearings. They need to call in experts. Yes, hear both sides. Hear multiple sides of this. But actually pass the laws instead of kicking the can to the VA. Because the VA, we know what bureaucracies are good at. They all study things to death and say, we don't have enough evidence. Well, when do you think you'll have enough evidence to make a decision? Well, we're still studying it. And meanwhile, literally decades can go by. We know what, you know, just in the time from the documentary film that came out 2 years ago, 2 years have gone by, and the VA is still studying it. And the issue wasn't new then. The issue had already been around for quite a few years, because these open burn pits were being used, you know, from 2001 onwards.
You know, David,
from coming home. Go ahead, Rick.
I think what's going to have to happen with the burn pits is the same thing that did happen with the Agent Orange and Camp Lejeune, which is, you know, in the Agent Orange, that took a very long time to finally pass, but there was enough public outcry that Congress finally did what they were supposed to do from the beginning, and they got it done. And then Camp Lejeune came along, and thank goodness for a couple of people, Jerry Esminger, who's been on the show, and Mike Partain, who's been on the show, and that group, they finally got something done. But it was only through the efforts of the Agent Orange voice and the veterans of the Agent Orange voice and people like Jerry Esminger and Mike Partain did something get accomplished. So with the burn pits, you know, we're going to have to keep beating the drum. And, you know, maybe there'll be some people who will be able to step up and, you know, sing loud enough that Congress will finally get it'll finally get their attention, and they'll finally do the right thing like they did with Agent Orange and Camp Lejeune. But for I seriously doubt that that Congress on its own will get it done.
I agree with you. It's going to require pressure on Congress. But what I'm saying is Congress could fix this in a month or a couple months.
Yeah.
They hold hearings. But the power, the holding point is in the committee, because nothing happens. There's not going to be a vote in the floor of the House or the Senate just on this issue. What first has to happen is the bill has to go through the committee. But we saw this. And the example you gave, Rick, of the Camp Lejeune is an excellent example. You know, Jerry Zeninger and the others in his organization, Mike Partain and others, what's amazing was they got Congress to actually pass a statute initially on the health care coverage for Camp Lejeune. So Congress passed it as a statute. They held hearings. They made it as a statute. In other words, as opposed to leaving it up to the VA. But that's on the healthcare side. Now, what Congress did not do for the Lejeune contaminated water veterans was for the service connection for disability compensation. They did kick it over to the VA, and the VA, as you know, it took them a while, but they ultimately published regulations that listed a much shorter list. Of 8 as opposed to the 15 illnesses or diseases that were on the healthcare list, you know. But my point being, just as Congress got its act together, the committee held hearings. If it'll get through the committee, what we've seen, you know, at least in the last 5 or 6 years, is if it gets out of the Veterans Committee, the House or the Senate, they'll just rubber stamp it. And that's one, these veteran issues, for the most part, are pretty bipartisan. There's not going to be a lot of disagreement on the floor of the House or the Senate. And an example of what I'm talking about is this Appeals Modernization Act, Rick. You know, you and I saw this thing on its way. We were talking about it on our show 2 years ago. And once it made it through the committee, it passed both houses without any opposition. So they're just going to rubber stamp it. So the power is the power to either make it happen or to keep it from happening is in the committees. And that's where the veteran groups need to put pressure on the members of the committee to hold hearings, but also to write a bill that will say, all right, what we already know from what's been reported by the hundreds of thousands of veterans who've reported some health problem that they reasonably think has come from exposure to these open burn pits. Make a list and call the experts that we know already exist, you know, experts attested that were in the burn pits documentary. Call them for Congress. You know, we know what the standard of proof is in veterans' claims on other issues. It's the as likely as not standard, which means is there at least a 50% likelihood? They don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt like a criminal case. So that's the path that needs to be taken. There needs to be pressure on members of these veterans' committees on the House and the Senate to draft this legislation, hold hearings, and move forward. But we already know who the opposition is going to be. It's going to be the VA, unfortunately, and probably a few veteran groups that the VA has enough leverage over who are going to. They're not going to actively oppose it because their membership would kill them. But what they would do would be, well, we need to study it further because we don't want to leave any veterans behind. We need to study to make sure we've got a complete list. Baloney. What they need to do is take what they have and move forward. It may not be entirely perfect, but for the sake of these veterans and their families, we can't have what they did with Agent Orange, where it took them, you know, 20, 25 years before they even acknowledged what was going on. So I'm
you know, David,
on a little bit of a soapbox here, Rick. What do you think?
No, and you bring up another. That's what tonight's about. Another issue. Our adversary in this whole process is the VA. And the VA, you know, has never taken that position that we're, quote unquote, your adversary. Rather, they like to say we're here to help you and we're here to, you know, to assist you, which is a bunch of, you know what. You know, prior to me doing the veterans law, I was involved in a lot of federal cases and state cases, a lot of state cases too, but I was in a lot of trials at the federal level. During those proceedings, I had lawyers on the other side that I could pick up the phone and call and talk to. I even had cases that were complex cases where the federal judge actually gave us his home phone number. And, of course, we didn't use it. We use it sparingly, extremely sparingly. But the fact is that the federal judge was willing to give the attorneys who were on the case the phone number because what we were all trying to achieve the same thing, which is the resolution of the case, whichever way that may fall, whether it would fall on my side or the other side. The goal was to get to the truth and get a fair and reasonable decision, whether it came from the bench, from the judge, or from a jury. We don't have that process with the VA. I mean, I can't pick up the phone and call someone at the VA and say, hey, can you check on Joe Smith's case? You know, the case has been pending for a while, and just give me an update. You can't do that. You know, you get letters from, you know, we get these routine boilerplate letters that your case is now in process. We are reviewing your case. Who's reviewing your case?
Right.
Okay. And not only who, but where is that person? Is that person, if he's a Florida resident, you would think that, well, it's being heard, you know, being checked, you know, reviewed down in St. Pete. Well, guess what? More likely than not, your case is not in the state of Florida. Definitely not in St. Pete. It's definitely not in the state of Florida. It might be in Boise, Idaho. I just got one the other day. It's up in New Hampshire. 3 weeks ago, I got one. It's in Maine. So not only do we not know who the person is reviewing the case, but we have no idea where that person is. And then I only find out about it because when I'm requesting a hearing at the decision review level, they have to send the case back to Florida because I'm entitled to that hearing before a decision review officer. But up until that point, I had no idea that, and I just got one today in the mail, that the case was up in New York State. But they, you know, whoever was handling the case said, well, you've requested a hearing. So because you're a Florida resident, we're sending it back to Florida. Well, that was news to me. Well, I'm glad it's back in Florida, but I had no idea it was in New York. How can you possibly run a system that's set up like that? You can't. And, you know, we just have to continue doing what we're doing. And veterans, you know, whether you're using a lawyer or a DAV or a VSO, or even if you're trying to do it yourself, you know, you just can't give up because that's what they're trying to do. They're, you know, again, it all comes back to the money. And they have actuaries. I used to do insurance defense, and I was also, you know, doing plaintiff's work. I know the playbook for insurance companies, and the VA playbook is no different than the playbook that the insurance companies use. You know, the insurance companies always, from the time you had a case, we'll take a basic rear-end collision case. That case gets sent over to the insurance company. The adjuster takes it. And at that point, they put a value on it. We'll just throw out $100,000. So that adjuster who's handling that claim, his goal is either to settle the case within the $100,000 limits or get an outright, go to jury for a jury trial, and the jury turns around and finds that the insurer was not guilty of the accident. But in the insurance company formula playbook, it's all about the money. So the adjuster turns around and comes back, and, you know, I used to sit down with them all the time. I'd say, look, I know you got $100,000 on this case. Let's settle it right now for $75,000. You've settled under the policy limits. My client's happy because we don't have to go through a deposition and a trial, and everybody's happy. That's the way it worked. It was all about the money. The VA is no different. And for them to even tell me that it's not about the money, it's about the money. David, you and I on a PTSD case, tell me that you can actually sit back and take a 30% PTSD rating versus a 50% PTSD rating and be able to juggle the difference between the two ratings. The VA routinely throws out the 30% instead of the 50. They could have thrown out the 50 to the veteran, but they throw out the 30. What's the difference? $200 to $300. That's the difference. The difference isn't lying in the subjective standard that you can read for a 30% to a 50%, because it's so darn close that it really takes somebody who's really intelligent to figure out the difference. And we know there's no real intelligence over at the VA. Well, I better get off my soapbox.
Well, I think what we see is that it seems to be that most of the VA, medical examiners or psychologists or psychiatrists, this is generalizing, but I think it's an accurate generalization, they tend to understate the severity of a veteran's psychological disability. Another thing that they tend to do is, at least some of them, their strategy appears to be that they're looking for any trauma in a person's pre-military life, their childhood or their teenage years or something, to explain why this combat veteran has come back from Iraq with severe PTSD. You know, that they'll, you know, were you abused as a child? Were you something or else? You know, and to try to undercut it, which I think is inexcusable. You know, it's a fair question to ask, but when it looks like the VA is clearly ignoring the overwhelming evidence of this combat veteran, that David, they suffered. Go ahead.
I had three cases in the last 7 days of my clients going to CMP exams for PTSD.
Yeah.
The questions were all about, how was your parents' marriage? Did you, you know, how was your relationship with your father? How was your relationship with your mother? How were you in school, in high school? The veteran was with, and this was like, all three of them said the same thing to me on different days.
Yeah, well, that was my point. That's another strategy. Yeah, yeah.
And in all three cases, did they not, until the veteran, because I told the veteran, you know, I gave the veteran a bunch of questions to ask the examiner. You know, the veteran shouldn't be examining the examiner, but that's what you have to do.
Right.
And I said, you know, in all three cases, the veteran said, wait a second. You haven't asked me about my military service. I was in Iraq. This is what happened to me in Iraq. And by then, the examiners basically wanted to wrap it up. Because here's my other pet peeve about these examiners. Their goal is to continue to get these contracts. LHI companies, the big one.
Yeah.
Their goal is to get these contracts from the VA. And their formula is to get as many of these veterans in their door, because that's what they work on. They work on volume. They don't work on their decisions. In fact, it behooves them to make sure the decision that they make for these veterans is so limited or minimalized or denied so that they can keep getting these contracts. Again, it's about the money. It's about their money, that whatever the contract is that they have with the VA, they want to keep that thing going. Imagine if they did the right thing and they started pumping out 50, 70% and 100% on PTSD cases. You think they'd have those contracts for long? I bet.
Oh, heck no. Heck no. Yeah, and that LHI, that's Logistics Health Incorporated. And, yeah, as you said, they have every financial reason to minimize or to not service-connect stuff. So, yeah, you're right. And I think, Rick, your strategy is a great one, which is to prep the veteran before going in there to say, you know, this is what this case is about. It's about my service in Iraq or Afghanistan, the trauma I had there, and not spend 20 minutes out of a 30-minute interview talking about the guy's childhood, you know. So, and the other thing veterans have to be aware of is that the examiner will not necessarily thoroughly or accurately or fairly put in the report what the veteran said. It may start off with, well, veteran, how are you doing today? I'm okay. Well, you know, a lot of veterans are stoic. They're trained to be mentally and physically tough. They're not complainers. You know, they wouldn't be in the military, they wouldn't be in combat for long if they were. And so they'll put down, oh, veteran reports that he's fine. Well, he's not. And it kind of goes from there. So these are all things that veterans need to be aware of. And
here's another tip that I give to my vets, and I tell them, when you're done with the exam, go get a cup of coffee and sit down and make notes about what occurred at the exam. And then when you get back to your home and you're by your computer, or even text it, text that information or email that information to who's ever representing you so that they can put that in the file.
Yeah.
You know, that's
great advice.
You know,
Rick, we're about running out of time tonight, so I perhaps we ought to transition quickly to our wrapping things up, because we're about out of time. But I think that's great advice. I hope our listeners take that to heart if they have a claim. So we've got about a minute left, and Rick, you want to mention the coaching into care?
Sure. Many of our veterans do struggle with psychological and physical problems. And there is an important VA program called Coaching into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at 1-800-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching in the Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening tonight to the Veterans News Hour. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and the Corey and Hurley Law Group, and thank our producer here at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station. Until then, hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.